Good morning, and welcome to this Liberia Working Group meeting. Today we're talking about women and their role in Liberia's reconstruction. And we're partnering with the Initiative for Inclusive Security, which has worked quite closely with two of our panelists, Lema Bowie and Juanita Jarrett. So I'll let Carla say something about them in a minute. But following their presentation, we'll also hear from Wafat Ofosuama, who is a senior gender specialist with the Gender Development Anchor at the World Bank. And there, her responsibilities include promoting and analyzing the policy, legal, gender, and social dimensions of development. And she'll provide an overview of the bank's efforts in facilitating the role that women can play in Liberia's reconstruction. So I will turn it over without further ado to Carla.
Thanks. Is it all right if I sit?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Carla Coppell, and I direct the Initiative for Inclusive Security. For those of you who don't know, the Initiative for Inclusive Security advocates for more broadly inclusive peace processes around the world. And we focus particularly on women's inclusion and why women should be included in peace processes. Our position really is that women, the exclusion of women is to the detriment of peace-building efforts, that women add something different and something unique to efforts to make peace endure. And you have a lot of the research that we've done on analyzing the added value women provide to peace processes outside. So you can get some of that. It's some of the basis for the analysis we do. And I have two colleagues, Michelle Page and Jessica Gomez. Jessica, you want to just put your hand up if you're interested in hearing more about us. Michelle's back there as well. We're here today to talk about Liberia. Liberia is a country we've been working in since 1999. We have a network of women peace builders, and among our network members is President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So we're particularly vested in how Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's presidency goes and in trying to be of assistance. And it's my great honor, and I wanted to thank Dorina for hosting this event, and thank Wafis for being here. She's our partner in crime. We worked just most recently together in February on the Gender Symposium in conjunction with the Partners Forum that was held here for the donors to get together and talk about rebuilding Liberia. My task this morning is mostly to introduce two of my favorite Liberians in the whole wide world. So it's a welcome task that I do with pleasure. Lema is the furthest on the right. She's the executive director of the Women Peace Security Network Africa, which is based in Accra, Ghana, and she's a founding member and former coordinator of the Women in Peace Building Network, West Africa Network for Peace Building. And the reason I have to look at my paper is because I know it by its acronym. So if I was just going to say, oh, she's from WIPNET and WAPNET, then I'd be okay, but I don't know that that would be all that meaningful for all of you. Juanita is really one of the deans of the women's movement in Liberia. She was a founding member of the Mono River Women's Peace Network, which you may be familiar with, is a network that involves women from Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia, and won the UN Peacebuilding Prize some time ago. It's really a famed organization. She also was a founding member of the Association of Female Lawyers of Liberia and was its first Secretary General. She is an attorney. And any of you, and I assume most of you who are working in Liberia, have probably heard of AFIL and MARWAPNET, both. So I will, without further ado, turn first to, now I don't remember what it is. Lema's going first, and she's going to talk a little bit about the women's role in the peace process and then in the elections. And then we'll turn to Juanita, who will talk a little bit more about the broader context and then our recent work within the context of the gender symposium and donor conference. So Lema. Take it away, Lema.
Thank you, Carla. As she said, I'm from the Women, Peace, and Security Network Africa, and we're based in Accra, Ghana. I bet you're wondering what this Liberian woman is doing in Ghana and leaving Liberia. Actually, WIPSEN Africa is a pan-African women's network, and what we're hoping to do and what we've started to do is to work with women across West Africa and some parts of Africa, building on our experience from the Women Peace Building Network. We thought it was time we move away from a male-dominated organization and start something on our own and see how we can further push the agenda of women. So we will basically be engaging, and currently we've started engaging with the Economic Community of West African State, ECOWAS, to see how we can move from just the bottom level of just grassroots mobilization, which was so good, and I think we have a PhD in it, and move to top level policy advocacy in issues of women, peace, and security. So that's the kind of work that we've started doing. You all know the story of Liberia. It's a familiar story. By just being here, I'm sure people know that Liberia had gone from one of the worst civil wars in Africa to a country that is recovering slowly. But how did we get to that point? It was not an easy journey. It took 14 years of different kinds of work. And to sit here and take credit, it wasn't a one organization thing. It was something that started, I like the way Carla put it, that Juanita is a dean. Because these women started in 1991. When the advocacy for peace and security started in Liberia in 1991, it started with a lot of marches and fasting prayers, the traditional things that women were used to doing, going out there in white. And then between 1991 and 1993, they got more bold and decided, okay, we'll get involved and go out to where the peace talks are being held. And those days, the table was all male. So they would stand at the door and cry to be let in, as if it wasn't their right to be in that room. And between 93, 94, 95, you know that Liberia had 14 years of recurrent conflict. In 2003, and one sheikh in Liberia, Sheikh Kafuma Kone, says Liberia is the only country that has gone from bad to worse to ridiculous. That was the trend that the conflict took. So every time it increased, it got worse. And every time you did an intervention plan, it had to be even more strategic. So in 2003, 1997 saw Taylor's election. His failure to engage into reconciliatory democracy led to an upsurge again of the war in 1999. And the war started from 1999. In 2003, I think that's when the Sheikh said it became ridiculous. Because that's when the worst atrocities were committed against women, children. Rape was a toy of war, not a tool anymore. Young boys would bet how many women. It wasn't about age. It wasn't about beauty. It defied beauty. It went beyond everything. Age, the older you were, the better you were to be raped. Because they felt, for the African society, women stopped engaging in sexual activity at a certain age. So, okay, these are good as new. So in 2003, a group of civil society, ordinary women like myself, mother of four children, internally displaced women, decided that we're going to even take it further. We're going to confront the powers of terror and madness in our country. We started the famous Women of Liberia Mass Action for Peace campaign. This campaign took us from every part of Liberia. We went to Accra, we went to Sierra Leone, we went to rebel bases, and we met with them. And at the end of the day, this campaign paid off. We saw peace in 2003. But usually what is expected of women, after you sign the peace agreement, we go back, we dance, we beat the drums, we kill some chickens and goat, and we have a big celebration, and that's it. We went back around the table and said, is this what we want? Have we really attained what we thought we started to do? And the answer was a resounding no. We need to do something more. What do we need to do? As it is, for some of us who even had a first degree, we could not understand the comprehensive peace agreement, let alone the thousands of women who followed us. So we said we'll sit down, have a plan, a five-day meeting of all of the different women's groups, think tank, bring them together, and let's demystify this agreement. And one of the languages we heard from other people when we were in Accra at the peace talk was that this peace agreement has no benchmark. So you don't know between when and when what is supposed to be happening. So we sat down for 3 days, invited 80 women leaders from all over Liberia and said, let's sit and turn this thing into something real. We demystified the peace agreement. We set benchmarks. And the way we set the benchmarks was that it was so simple that even the woman in the village knew that at what point in time something was supposed to be happening according to the peace agreement. So between December 2003 to April 2004, you will see people coming into your communities to take the guns from the boys. So if a week passed and you didn't see people coming into your community to do this, get on the streets with your placards. So with those practical benchmarks, we did that. In 2003, as you all know, December, the first day of disarmament, it failed miserably. But then why did it fail? We were protesting, we were doing everything, and the men loved us those days when we were making our bodies the barrier for peace. But by the time peace came, everyone was saying to us, go back home and sit. Even when we were saying we have a stake in this disarmament process, they said, no, you can't do anything. It's a militarized process. So when the process failed in December, we went to the UN. But that morning, what we did was to call all of the generals and say to them, we need to talk. And these generals came after we had engaged them. The UN called them to a meeting and they said, accompany us. We were about five women from the think tank group who went with them. By the time we got to the UN office, they said, you can't go in. We'll only take the generals. And the generals turned around and said, if they can't come, we are not coming in. So they said, okay, so the whole time we spent 3 hours in that meeting, a Twitter Cooper, myself, and three other women. Every time they said something, we write a piece of note and pass it to the general. This is what we want. Every time they said, so we had really, we formed our power base, especially with them. Afterwards, Ambassador Klein called and said, let the Liberian women take over. They know exactly what they're doing. We went into the camps, we engaged the fighters. And it calmed down, and that was the beginning of our engagement. Today, people will tell you that in Liberia, and I don't mean to sound conceited, but Liberia has one of the best practical experiences of women engaging in the disarmament process in the world. We thought, okay, disarmament is successful. Do we go back and sit? Hell no. Sorry for that, but that was the word. We are not going to sit back. We'll continue to be engaged in this process. We started out by going out and we did an assessment of the electoral field. And what we found out was that women particularly were not interested in going to register to vote. Because all along, the government structures have never benefited women. So these women were saying to us, why should we? At the end of the day, the men would take it and it would not benefit us anymore. And then we said to them, we need to do something. You need to go out there. We went to NDI and IRI and said, this is what you need to do. No one listened. 10 days, the registration process started, and 5 days for the registration process to end, they sent for me, Lima, we have a problem. In the market areas, and those were the areas that we told them, 10 communities, you won't get women to register to vote. These women are not registering. I said, "How? Why am I hearing myself?" You know, so we went out there, 200 women in the streets for 5 days. We registered 7,485 women in 5 days. When it came time to vote, we had to be out there. One of my favorite campaign messages was, where is the woman's place? The woman's place is on the hill in Liberia, where the parliamentarian and where the executive mansion is. It's called Capitol Hill, like here. So the woman's place is not in the kitchen anymore. It's on the hill. We got the results that we got in the elections. Where are we today? Unfortunately, the woman's leadership, we celebrated, and Liberian women are like, we have a female president, and she's going to do it all for us. But that is not the case. And I don't mean to sound critical about our president, but this is the reality. She has so much on her hand that she can't do it all. Women need to move away and understand that this is not a woman's president. She is a woman, but she is the president of a nation. And if our issues, we are even at the most advantageous stage that she is a woman and she understands the issue that we will be bringing to her. We need to continue our advocacy. We need to continue to develop policies. We need to continue to be in the limelight. Unfortunately, we are not. And that reality sunk in a few weeks ago when we came to the donor conference and she listed, outlined all of the issues of priority and left out two issues, gender and transport. We went back to the hotel and the gender minister sat. And then someone said, Madam Minister, did you notice that in the president's speech, She did not mention us. And she said, yes, I know. But in our minds and amongst ourselves, though we're a bit disappointed, but for someone like me with the kind of spirit that I have, I said to them, this is a challenge. We shouldn't take it in a bad faith. We should take it in a good faith that we need to buckle up and we need to strengthen ourselves and we need to move ahead. And this is what but one of the biggest weaknesses that we have is that we lack a lot of the Liberian women. We do a lot of grassroots mobilization on different things, but we lack the skills for policy advocacy. We lack the skills for policy development. We lack different skills. If you look at on the economic side, and I'm glad she's here. Women have been at the bottom of the pyramid. Grassroots economic activities, we need to move up. In peace and security issues, we need to move up. And it was evident when we came to the symposium, all of those issues, when it came to the point of how can we do this, we were stuck. Because all we know in our mind is mobilized on issues that are tangible. But we need to move beyond that if our daughters may enjoy or continue to enjoy the leadership of women in Liberia. I'll stop there.
As Lemuel has said, the disarmament process in Liberia was very slow because those that the UN especially, who was assisting the disarmament process, failed to involve the women. So as long as the women were not there, things were very slow, atrocities continued to be committed. But once the women got in, because the women, they were the mothers of the fighters. They knew the nooks and crannies where these fighters were hiding their guns because they heard, they moved around and they heard through the children and other people. So once the women got in, things came to a halt. And then we ushered in a new government, but the policies were not truly engendered. And since the Initiative for Inclusive Security is out there to assist in the development of governments focusing on women's needs and women's rights, women were invited here in February to network and to ensure that policy and for the first time come together and put forth their policies to go through the government's own policy that they had and ensure that each policy or each pillar was engendered. So among the women that came, we had women who were victims of AIDS. And they got out and they spoke from their own experiences of what was lacking, what needed to be done. AIDS has become really rampant, but there are people with AIDS who are living longer because they have access to medications and so on, which is the retroviral drugs are so expensive that a woman first has to find food for her family before looking after herself. So we had women who were representing the AIDS groups who talked about the needs. We also had traditional women who talked about, despite the fact that 60% or nearly 80% of the women in Liberia are illiterate, they can still use their hands and get skills. We have traditional women who talk about teaching women to make bricks so that they can assist in the reconstruction. And they sell these bricks because right now, when people talk about bringing in the gazebo, I say, well, we have natural gazebo. We still, because we cannot afford cement, a lot of reconstruction is done through the use of mud bricks. In fact, they are even cooler. So these women make mud bricks and sell it as a means of livelihood. We had women representing that group at the donors conference so that they could hear, as we say, from the horse's mouth, from experienced women of all that is happening. Now, I'd just like to say a little something about who are these women of Liberia. The women of Liberia feel that they have a stake in that country. They have nowhere else to go. There are women who suffered rape. There are women whose sons, young sons and daughters, were enticed into gun-toting child soldiers. There are women who lost loved ones, who lost properties, who went from sleeping in their houses they have built, they have worked for and built, to being displaced. Lima was displaced for several years. I was displaced. I was even taken off the line twice to be shot because they said I looked like a particular group or tribe that was being sought for during the year wars. So, having suffered all of this, the women, when returned to Liberia, decided that this was enough. So, what I'm trying to say is that having suffered and gone through so much and lost so much, when you see women now playing a pivotal role, it's not so much because they want employment, but it's because they feel they have to let their voices be heard. They have to be part of the reconstruction process because they have nowhere else to go and they want a better, stable environment for themselves and for their children. There is no place like home. There's no place like home. So this is the background of the kind of women. We have women who taught, who were teachers to some of the rebel leaders. We have women who were classmates. So they were of some of the rebel leaders. Some of the teachers would say, oh, do you know I met so-and-so? You know, when he see me, oh, teacher, how are you? And of course, this particular woman, an older woman, she was so embarrassed for the situation. But that's how it was, because these young men, for certain reasons, went out and became rebels. And many of them were really educated also. I'd like to say, concerning the actual reconstruction, women have decided that if there's no collaboration, if there's no partnership, things will not progress. So for this matter, we have the women in government who are collaborating with the various women non-governmental organizations. Just recently, the United Nations Women Force from India, who are in Liberia to train the police force, met with the Association of Female Lawyers of Liberia to see how best they can collaborate to get out there to find out more about rape cases to ensure that the perpetrators are brought to justice. And the I must also tell you that the Association of Female Lawyers of Liberia has been an activist group since about 1992, because they decided also that enough is enough. So they try to use their expertise to ensure the protection of women and children. So you find them actually cooperating and using their defending rape victims in court. Because being a male-dominated society, you find that the men in court would laugh when there's a young rape victim coming to court, you know, because they don't take it seriously. But now the rape law has become more stringent, and rape is now a felony to be punished with drastic punishment. So the association, they all volunteer. Many have regular jobs, but they set time aside to volunteer and to aid rape victims. So this is a collaboration between one aspect of the UN and the women. You also have the Liberian Women Initiative. This is a group that is out there to educate women on their civil rights. They also engage in training, and we have the Concerned Christian Community. This is a women's group that is mostly focused in Bumming County. Very recently, they had a skills training where they trained women in tailoring. And then the government representatives over there promised the women that for the next school year, they will contract them to sew the uniforms for the children in that area. We pray that this goes through. So that would be a means of empowerment and of means of the women generating money for themselves and their families. We also have the Muslim women. Liberia is a country of Christians and Muslims. In fact, most of West Africa is like that. You are having one family, Christian and Muslim. So we have learned to work together side by side. There's one aspect of the war that sometimes you say out of some evil comes good. Before then, we didn't work before the war. We did not work so closely together. But after that, we're all humans. We all suffered the same atrocities, so we continue to work together. Another aspect of good coming out of evil is that many of our children who were displaced in the diaspora, for instance, in the neighboring Ivory Coast, many of them learned to speak French. And in Ghana, many of the women who went to Ghana learned skills in commerce, because the Ghanaian women, also in Nigeria, they have been business women for a very long time. So coming back to Liberia now, in the reconstruction process, they are using these skills. Children are excelling in French, women. In fact, many women with degrees from the University of Liberia, you'll find them at the market, because it's very hard to get jobs now in Liberia, so they're all self-employed, and because of that, they are selling, they have their own businesses. So there are organizations that are trying to assist women to get loans from the various banks and etc. for them to continue in their efforts. I didn't talk too much about the Mano River Women Peace Network, but when there is trouble in one country in the Mano River Union, it affects all the others. When Liberia's hostilities started, it affected Sierra Leone and it affected Guinea. The war, we all know that the war in Sierra Leone was a direct cause of the war in Liberia. Guinea suffered a brunt because refugees from Liberia and Guinea fled into Guinea, and Guinea was not prepared to handle so many refugees. Now, we have peace in Liberia, relative peace in Sierra Leone. They have elections coming up in July. I pray that it remains peaceful. And now, Guinea has her own problems. In fact, in Sierra Leone recently, we heard that because of the days of fighting in Guinea, there was no food in Sierra Leone, because that's where Sierra Leone used to get most of her food, and business went down. So you see, the Mano River Women Network, we try to engage governments to ensure that we always have a means of peace. Because without peace, naturally, there is no development. We had reached a certain stage where we're about to engage in trade along the border to continue to progress for ourselves and our family, but then when the war breaks up, we regress. You know, I mean, it's so sad. It is so sad. Anyway, we will take questions later, but what can the international community do? From my experience, when I was head of the Women NGO Secretary of Liberia, I found that the bureaucracy was a hindrance to what we wanted to do. If you really want to help somebody, find out their needs and give logistics for those needs. Don't tell us you must write a proposal from A to Z in this manner. They said, we want to help the women of Liberia, but they are not together. We got together. We are together now. Where's your help? Oh, you don't have any infrastructural office. We got an office. We had no money for the rent, the building, the repair. Sorry, we do not pay rent, we do not repair. But we have computers, we have desks, we have chairs. Where, I pray, ask you, do we put those desks and those chairs? So we had to store them in various offices. So if one wants to help, find the needs, let the women assist with assessment, and put aside bureaucracy. And also have exceptions. That's what I always say to the international community. There are one or two like UNIFEM who have come out and really pay rent. They continue to ensure the women get training. And not only in Monrovia, because Monrovia is not Liberia. We are pleased to say that throughout the interior, throughout the counties. For instance, in Nima County, where the 1990 hostilities really started, there was a woman who was head of an NGO who was also present to address the forum. And I myself was also surprised to see her. I said, you mean you are still in Nima County where all those rebels were, and you tell me you are doing A, B, C, D? I was so happy to hear that. So I will stop there, and then if there's anything else that you would like to know, and if we can answer, we'll do our best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me see if I can work this. Maybe you can help.
Christine.
I have a power. It's a very short presentation. It's 8 slides, so we can move quickly to a discussion, because I think that is one of the main purposes of this. As you know, after the war, and when Liberia was transitioning, still is transitioning from war to reconstruction, the bank was also reviewing its re-engagement strategy, because during the war the bank was not present at all. Can you all hear me? During the war, the World Bank suspended its operations in Liberia. So last year, the bank began reviewing its re-engagement strategy. And it prioritized three main areas. First of all, technical assistance to the government of Liberia in a whole range of areas, particularly preparing the overall development and reconstruction strategy for the country. The second area was emergency infrastructure work. I mentioned roads here, but infrastructure, just to make sure that, as Juanita said, Liberia is not just Monrovia. It's Monrovia and the rest of the country. So how to make sure communications and contact throughout the country was effective. The bank prioritized emergency infrastructure. And then the third area was dialogue around the interim poverty reduction strategy, which is, you know, mainly the first step in the process towards developing a full-scale poverty reduction strategy. Now, that was taking place most of the year before last, soon after the election, and through last year. Now, we've moved into a longer-term vision for the bank's work in Liberia, and that really prioritizes the key areas that the interim poverty reduction strategy identified, because the bank's work is supposed to be responding to the country's own strategy. And that those areas focus on economic revitalization, basic services and infrastructure, and governance and the rule of law. And the main, as a result of that, the bank has developed an interim strategy note, which is the equivalent of a country's assistance strategy. We have interim strategy notes for countries which are emerging from conflict, because we need to move in a more deliberate manner in working very closely with the country. Now, the both the IPRSP for Liberia and the bank's interim strategy note recognize that gender equality is very important for Liberia's reconstruction. They see women's economic empowerment as a means to promote both equitable poverty reduction and growth, eventually along the line. It's also a means to accelerate the Millennium Development Goal, which calls for promoting gender equality and women's economic development. And then overall, gender equality is seen in this strategic document as ways in which to enhance the overall development effectiveness of Liberia's strategies. Now, also, at the time that these two policy-level documents were being discussed, the bank also came up with a new gender policy, which is called Gender Equality as Smart Economics, and there are copies of that out there for you to take. And Liberia was selected as one of the focus countries for that new gender strategy. So that was sort of the background to our work in Liberia. Towards the end of last year, in October, we fielded the first mission to work with our partners in Liberia on first of all, to assess the situation in Liberia as far as women's economic empowerment is concerned. And focusing on the action plan, we decided to look at policy-level interventions that can make the emerging market in Liberia work for Liberian women, and look at agency-level interventions to improve women's ability to compete more effectively in those markets. And the markets we targeted were labor market. How do we work with our partners in Liberia to really get women to participate in some of the labor and workforce policies that were being put into place? The other was land market. How do we work again with government as they begin to review the land tenure situation in Liberia to make sure that women are not left behind in that process? Financial market, how do we promote women's access to finance? Not just microfinance, but you know, commercial credit so that they can grow their businesses. And then what about the agricultural product market? Because as you know, intuition tells us, women are very actively engaged in the agriculture sector, sometimes invisibly, but they play an active role in the production, if not of food crops, at least for some of the commercial crops as well. And we also indicated that infrastructure is really a very important, it underpins all of the development, because access to infrastructure, roads, electricity, telecommunications, etc., and those services are really a foundation for the effective functioning of these markets. And we realized that in doing all of this, we have to get in on the ground floor as the bank's own assistance to Liberia is being developed, because we did not want to end up with a set of women's economic empowerment activities that are not fully integrated into the bank's large-scale lending or grants or technical assistance. So our work in the gender unit has been very actively focused on working with our colleagues in the bank who are working in Liberia, the country director, the country economist, the infrastructure specialist, the education specialist, etc., working very closely with them. It's not easy because they are not used to working on these issues. I have to be very frank about that. The bank is not known as UNIFEM, for example. It's known as one of the organizations that gets in on the ground and works on women's issues. So we are building partnerships both within the bank with our economist colleagues as well as outside the bank. Now, we've targeted two main activities. The bank is doing a lot of analytical work just to get a good handle on what the situation is in Liberia so that it can intervene. And we decided to do the same. We have done a gender needs assessment that analyzes women's roles in the Liberian economy. Now, let me backtrack a little bit. We decided that our work on gender issues would be very strategically focused on women's economic empowerment. The other groups that who are working on rights-based, you know, women's access to legal services and rights, there are others who are working on access to girls' education, etc. We decided to focus on the area of economic empowerment, primarily to address some of the issues that Lema referred to, that there was a discussion at the Liberian Forum and not a reference to gender issues, because economists usually don't see those issues. So we decided to focus our work to really engage as effectively as we can with the policymakers at the very macro level. And when we went to on our first mission in October, we decided that we would work with our colleagues in the office to make sure the government determines that our counterparts will be not only the Ministry of Gender, but also the Ministry of Finance, so that we can work on you know, building the capacity of both institutions to be able to dialogue effectively on women's economic empowerment. So the needs assessment, which is being finalized right now, came up with four main findings. First is that women are the key players in agricultural production in Liberia. 53% of the agricultural labor force and responsible for 60% of agricultural production. These are the basic data that we have right now. We believe that when the LISGIS, the Liberian Institute for Statistics, comes up with various surveys that is doing, we would have even higher numbers. But now, for now, the conservative figures we have, that women really are key players. And that investing in female farmers is therefore essential to increasing rural productivity and revitalizing the rural economy. That is absolutely key if, you know, we are to, this peace is to gain ground and make a lasting peace. Women and communities in the rural areas need to have viable, sustainable livelihoods. Second is that similar gains could be expected in training and educating women in Liberia, especially as large number of them, the human capacity, all both males and females, but special efforts need to be made in investing in women, not just in basic education, but also skills-based training, and training that makes a link between basic education and life skills. And then third, Liberian women are dynamic entrepreneurs. 77% of self-employed women in the urban area proves that Liberian women are, you know, in the private sector. They are in self-employment. They are creating jobs for themselves to feed their family. And the fourth and most important finding is that Liberian women are currently absent from the profitable sectors like cash crops, like forestry, like mining, like infrastructure, and public works. So based on these four findings, we're going to be working with our colleagues who are developing the emergency infrastructure works, with our colleagues who are working in agriculture, with the Ministry of Agriculture and others, to really see how can we, in the policies that are being developed, make sure we take account of these findings. In the agriculture area, the bank is developing an infrastructure analytical work, doing an agricultural assessment of the entire sector and to be able to identify the entry point. And there we have a chapter. We have been working very closely with a team that's working on that to really go into much more detail about women's role in the agriculture sector. There's a land tenure study that the bank has commissioned, and we are also pursuing the opportunities to look at women's roles, women's access, the situation with both the legal and the cadastral system to see again what opportunities there are to strengthen women's access. The bank is also working on a core welfare indicator questionnaire. This is a questionnaire that will be fielded nationwide to really come up with some basic data on welfare indicators, income indicators, household level indicators, and we are working with them to make sure that the questionnaire will be designed in such a way that the survey will be able to come up with data that can be disaggregated by sex. Because we find that in our area of work, most of the time where women are absent and we ask the question, they say it's because the data are not available. We have nationwide data, but we really don't know whether it's 40% of women or 60% of women. So we're working to refine the questionnaire, especially the ones on employment, to make sure there are enough additional questions that will give us a fuller detail of what role women play in the economy. And then as Liberia begins to prepare its full poverty reduction strategy over the course of the next 18 months, we will be working primarily with the Ministry of Gender and Development to determine at an early stage what additional pieces of analytical work can be put in place so that when the full document is being drafted, we will be able to have sections or documents or data to put not just in the governance and rule of law pillar, but in the economic revitalization pillar. and in the basic services pillar on what specific interventions can be put in place for women. We also, in addition to this analytical work which I've just described, we're also moving very quickly to make sure that the emergency operations which the bank is engaging in right now also have a gender focus. We have done a very rapid assessment of the economic of roles of women in the infrastructure sector. You know, roads are being built. It is creating a lot of jobs, short-term jobs. What special efforts are being made to make sure that women will also be able to access some of those jobs? How is the contracting happening to make sure that the jobs will not go only to, you know, to men, but women will be able to assess that? And actually, there's a large mission that's going out next week, a World Bank European Union mission, which they're responsible for all the emergency public works. And we are participating in that, we being the gender group in that mission, first to obtain information about women's participation in those urban road projects, the types of work they're playing, how many of them are being employed by the contractors that have been hired to do this work, the types of skills they have or the types of skills they may need, and how one can put those in place. Also to look at, to come up with strategies that will be embedded in the large-scale emergency infrastructure works that the bank is developing right now, to have a special component on women, and then to develop a simple monitoring framework to make sure we are able to track these throughout the course of the project, to make sure we have some data at the end which we can use, and then, you know, to look for some specific key entry points which over the next six, because these are all on a fast scale, very emergency focused, and we want to make sure, because it's an emergency focused operation, we don't miss these opportunities to address women. Finally, we are also implementing or designing now a results-based initiative. We call them results-based initiatives because these are interventions focusing again on women's economic empowerment that are designed to show some results within a short period of time, but that have embedded in them an impact evaluation component, so that again we can measure the results of that intervention and come up with a way to scale it up into bank operations. This is a partnership. It's funded by the World Bank through our development grant facility, but it's a partnership between UNIFEM and the International Center for Research on Women. UNIFEM is the one responsible for designing and implementing the intervention, and the International Center for Research on Women is responsible for the impact evaluation component. The intervention we've come up with is an agriculture-based intervention for women in cassava production in Nimba County. You mentioned Nimba County. This is a group of women who started with focusing on peace, and at the end of the war, they have organized themselves into development type activities. They have a plot of land. When we met with them in October, they said to us, look, we need assistance with increasing our productivity, with improving our farming methods, with our marketing methods, etc. And so they've given us a whole range of issues. As you said, listen to the women's needs. We are listening, and as a result of that listening, it is taking a longer time to really identify the right type of intervention, which is sort of amenable to being scaled up into a bank operation. We would very much like to do a small-scale project, but we don't want to do it and leave it at that. We want to make sure it can be taken up by the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 million dollar operation that the bank engages in. So we are working on those. And overall, the guiding principles for everything we're doing and planning to do in Liberia is that it really has to have a very strong capacity building component. Building the capacity not just of the women we will be working with, but of the partners and with the Ministry of Gender, the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Public Works, and the Ministry of Finance, really building their capacity on the links between gender equality and economic development, poverty reduction, and economic growth. We have a lot of information about how important gender is for development as a whole, but we really don't have as much on those links. And we're trying to make sure those four ministries I have mentioned will be able to discuss very easily why gender issues are important when they are writing those macro-level big policy statements for Ellen and her colleagues to discuss with the donors in the international community. The second is sort of emphasize piloting and scaling up operations, because yes, we want to be very creative and innovative, but we also want to make sure those creative and innovative interventions can be picked up by the bank's work. We really want to be able to monitor and measure progress. As Lima says, with the peace agreement, there were no benchmarks. So we come up with a good document, but we don't say what we're going to do and how we're going to monitor progress. We really are focusing on that. Because the reason why we are highlighting that is that we still constantly have to be making the business case for why focusing on women matters, makes a difference in this context. It's always justifying, constantly just. So if we can measure those results and those impacts as we go along, we can use them as the evidence for why it's important to focus on women. We really want to focus on rapid results methodologies. We want to and even though our progress has been slowed a little bit, we really want to identify activities that can bring some money, some income into women's hands within a short period of time, because it has been a very long time. People need to be able to see some progress now. And then I've said this several times in my presentation, we really want to make sure that the sectors that we target are also sectors that the World Bank as an institution has indicated is a priority. So agriculture, land issue, labor force issues. Those three for especially are top priority for the bank, so they are top priority for us too. And I talk as if I'm not part of the bank, but you have to realize the gender group needs to make sure that gender issues are picked up within our institutions before they can be presented to government as well. So we really want to focus on the main areas that the bank as an institution target, which is analytics. And so every analytical work the bank is doing, we are making sure the questions and the design are such that they can identify women's roles in there. The lending and some lending operations are being designed now. For example, there's a lease. The Liberia Agency for Community Empowerment, there's going to be a second phase of that. We will be working with them. There may be an agriculture project. There's an infrastructure project. In all of those areas, we want to make sure the focus on gender is maintained. And then there will be some grant-based activities. And actually, most of the operations I have talked about as gender work, for example, what we're doing with UNIFEM and the needs assessments that we've done and all of those for us are grant-based activities. So basically that's a quick overview of the work we're doing. Some of it is at a very elementary, basic stage, but in other areas, especially on the gender needs assessment, we've made a lot of progress in identifying the key areas for intervention, and we are moving ahead rapidly. First of all, on our own, but in areas where we feel others have a better capacity or skill and better access to communities than we do, like the UNIFEM example that I've mentioned, we then partner with those people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We now have about 35 minutes for some questions and discussion for all of our panelists. So floor is yours. And also if you could just identify yourself. And keep the question short.
My name is Peggy Sadie Nelson, and I'm with one of those organizations that we've listened to at first, the National Democratic Institute. And my question for you is about the generals that you're working with, actually. You said that you got the buy-in of the generals, and the generals actually took you to the United Nations. so important to work with men, to get the support of men, to engagement. And so I'm wondering how you got the support of the generals and how it was the generals said, no, we're not going in unless people are coming with them.
Well, over the period of our work, we became a household name in Liberia. And one of our biggest challenge as we did the work that we did was when President Taylor challenged us that you've come to me, you need to find the rebels. And that's the only way I will take you seriously, or else I see this as you being on party line. Without any money, without any knowledge of where rebels are located, we started our journey. And fortunately for us, we found them in Sierra Leone, where the Sierra Leonean women who were working for Peace, Mawopnet, and the Wipnet group there called us and said, we understand that some of your rebel leaders frequent so-and-so hotel. And we sent three women with their tickets and $200 into Sierra Leone. Fortunately for them, they got to the airport and saw a delegation of pastors going into Sierra Leone. And they said, we don't even know where we're going to stay. And then these pastors said, well, we have some extra money from the World Council of Churches, and we are also on a peace mission, so we could just include you all as part of our mission. And when they got there, this group of women had already connected to where they could find these people. And we publicized that so-and-so meeting was taking place at so-and-so place, and the women were able to meet. So by the time they came back, by the time we went to Accra, in our engagement, though sometimes it was a bit biased, but we tried to give it a balance, we gained that kind of respect from both ends. So by the time we came back to Monrovia after the signing of the peace agreement, people knew that we meant business, that we had not aligned with either Taylor or with the rebels. We gave no nonsense messages to both groups, and we were kind of like a bit objective about the work that we did. But also the strategy we used was that we were not interested in who took over the political space of Liberia. All we wanted was peace and security. Even though today, if you ask them, they'll tell you that was a lie, because that we have a woman's president. Maybe at the end of the day, we didn't think that we're going to get there. But when we got to a particular point, we realized that we could even go further. But first, a political agenda was not the thing. So that kind of respect and that kind of objectivity that we had in the work that we did, I mean, gave us that leverage with the generals.
I'd just like to add that we have to realize that the heads of states, whether they're male like Mr. Taylor, he's human. The generals themselves are human. And a lot of them were really tired. They were really tired. But they were ashamed to kind of extend a hand. So many of them were happy that the women were there as brokers. And an advantage, Liberia is a very small country with a small population. Sierra Leone is a small country too. So that networking is somehow easier. Sometimes you find people know each other, or knowing somebody who knows somebody, the networking becomes kind of easier. So all those are some of the good aspects of how we attain the peace process.
I just wanted to add one thing, because we don't hear very much about the role of Liberian women here in bringing about peace. And I remember when I first went to Liberia last April, and there's a book, there's more than one book, but there was a book that I had found on the role of women in the Liberian peace process. So I read the book and went to Liberia, and I thought, you know, it'd be really interesting to see what the perspective is of some of the men who are in power now regarding the role of these women, because the book was obviously written by a fan, you know, somebody who was a real believer in the role of these women. So I was at a lunch and I was seated next to the vice president, and I said, you know, what do you think? I mean, in terms of bringing about peace, what do you think was the role of these women? He said, well, at a minimum, I can tell you peace would not have come with the speed that it came without the women, period. That they were the ones that made the negotiations, gave the negotiations impetus and a motor. And, you know, he stopped necessarily short of saying it wouldn't have come at all, but he was absolutely open in giving a great deal of credit to the women's movement in Liberia for bringing about peace. So I just wanted to add that, because I think it's a little bit of independent verification of the role these women really had in in being fed up enough to push these people to make peace, because it's quite fundamental.
Other questions?
I'm David Aronson with the Institute. I had two questions. One is to ask you to just elaborate a little bit further on the leverage that you had and the means of persuasion that you had at your disposal. I think one of the reasons we typically, I don't know what that means exactly, a lot of people may overlook the role of women, is that women are seen as not having a lot of leverage, a lot of power, and therefore in these negotiations over power, they're not seen as real actors. So, but clearly, I mean, one of the pathways through which you asserted yourself was simple, you know, sort of Barbara Jordan-esque assertion. You know, you said, we're here, we're not going anywhere, deal with us. But I'm wondering what other means of persuasion, what other leverage did you have to get what were really some pretty awful people to sit down and listen to you and take you seriously?
Well, I think one thing is, when you have been bitten, they're saying once bitten, twice shy. Once you have been hurt, you've been bitten, you become more determined, you become more courageous, no matter what. In the heat of the war in 1991, we were just fed up, and women would say, I'm going out there to those rebels, whether they shoot me in the head or whether they do not. I think it's that courage, it's that determination that you cannot let the country go to ruin, complete ruins, because you have a stake in the country, you have a stake in the peace process. It's like having your child, and you will save that child, whether you know you also may get drowned if that child is drowning. It's that determination. And then Liberia, Africa, even though it's a male-dominated society, the respect for women is great. Women are considered as the mothers. Even Mr. Taylor, as evil as he was, when the rebels almost reached Monrovia, we, the women, were trying to get a meeting with him. He refused to see us. But when they were Sarah Marshall Monrovia, he invited the women. What are the women saying? The rebels are, what are the women saying? Then we say, oh, now you want to talk. You know, so there's that respect for women also, that and it's that greatly the respect also, and along with our courage and determination.
Well, I sometimes beg to differ with the respect for women in the Liberian society. I call it a double standard contradictory role. And for years we live in that. Publicly, we are honored and cherished. If this room is full of people seated and Liberian women walk in here, all of the Liberian men will stand up so that the women will sit. But in their homes, they are abused. And if you look at the policies, we were abused in those policies. There was no law on inheritance rights for women who were engaged in polygamous practices. There were no laws on rape. So respect that? I don't take that. I mean, the double standard rule. So when we started the peace work, we used that edge of that double standard. We respect you publicly. So there's no way that when you get out there, we allow the world to see us beating you off the street. Is that sinking in? Am I making sense here? You know, we love you. So we got to keep showing to the world that we love you. But just let me catch you in the back, I'll deal with you. So they never caught us in the back, because everything we did publicly. No, when we got to see President Taylor on the day that we went to see him, he actually did not believe that the women of Liberia would defy, because before then he had declared that even if my mother got on the street, beat her off the street. So when we asked to see him, he said we could come to see him, but then he left a message at the gate that if less than 20 women came to see him, because he didn't believe that we would defy him, they should not allow us in. That morning, we had over 2,000. And then when we got there, he said, I will only see 20 in my office. And I said, no. It's either he come down to see us or no deal. He finally decided, okay, I will come down. He came down with this sham of, oh, I have this terrible flu, but because you are my mothers and I love you all, I had to come down. Double standard again. Privately, he had different orders. Publicly, he could tell the television crew this. The second thing that worked for us, which I will agree with her, and I always use this metaphor, when you push to the wall, you have two options. You either go through that wall or you fight back. And for us, we were not going to fight back with violence. We're going to use the means. And when we started the protest, the first day we went to Parliament, the Speaker of Parliament and I practically engaged. We were almost going to a physical fight. Because this whole double standard of publicly respected and loved, when he came and saw us sitting out, it was raining cats and dogs. And women from the internally displaced camps had brought their kids. He came and saw that, and the press was there, BBC, VOA. This is a disgrace to the Liberian man, that our women are sitting out there with their children. So he went, called security, ordered them to remove all of the cars from in the garage of the Parliament building so that we could go under there. He had to show he cared. And then he came to me and said, who's the leader of this group? I stood up and said, I am. Can you all please go under there? And I told him, no. He said, why? I said, because when you start shooting, or when you refuse to end the war, you don't give us umbrellas to run from our houses. So we are not leaving. His first word was, why in the hell you want to embarrass this government? And then I said, I don't want to embarrass the government. Then he went back at me with some four-letter word. I went back at him with four-letter word. And the press kept moving microphone back and forth. Until finally, one of the older women came and said, stop it. But he was really very angry. But we were angry too. Because we had seen the worst atrocities and we were really pushed to the wall. So those were the two things, you know, that double standards in loving their women and not treating them badly. But all the same, we didn't have any laws to protect us. In West Africa, other women in West Africa will tell you, Liberian women, when we went to Ghana, the men were really amazed that our men would stand up on the bus for us to sit down. But in the homes, we endure the same thing. So those two things were the leverage that we had.
In a sense, it's like the civil rights movement where it came forced the United States to stand up to its publicly stated ideals, even though privately.
Yeah.
My second question, if I could, I don't want to take up too much time, but it strikes me that one of the things I wish I saw more of was sort of cross-fertilization among African countries, and I'm thinking specifically of the DRC here, and the terrible amount of rape and violence that is occurring against women in Eastern Congo. And so I'm wondering if an organization like the bank or others might be interested in bringing some of the women from Liberia to the DRC to sort of talk about their experiences so that they can sort of get some, I think they'd have a lot more credibility coming from other African women. Just a thought, more than a question.
Well, this network that we've started, one of our biggest dreams is that because we've seen quite a stride from West Africa in the work, in community mobilization, all like that, we thought, okay, this is something that we can do. And in May, unfortunately, we're having a strategic reflection forum, and we thought, okay, we'll bring women from all over Africa so that we share experiences and lessons learned. Unfortunately, the group that is funding us is saying, they can only pay for women from West Africa because we're based in West Africa. And we've been trying to get other groups to send, we've gotten one or two persons to agree to send some women from Uganda and from other places, but we haven't really been fortunate. But hopefully in the future, those are the kind of work that we hope to do, look at. How can we, because sometimes, once we went to the AU, where we were meeting with some of the women from the AU, and one of the women in the AU said, you know, I am dying for the day where there will be a meeting of AU leaders and you have women from these civil society groups come and give their testimonies or tell their stories of how they made peace and security possible during conflicts. He said, because these leaders, they don't hear any of these things. All they hear or all they think is that we made it possible through our high table negotiations. You know, so we're hoping that we can do some of those things, and it's good that Carla and some of the other people are here. Maybe they would think about
doing some, and they do, you all do some of those kind of work.
Two things. First, I just wanted to add to Layman Juanita's comments on your first question, and there were some other strategies that you guys used. For example, when the negotiations were stalled and people were sort of talking a lot of hot air, they informed the women who were in the negotiating teams, but not the men, and then locked them all in until they started negotiating in earnest. And I met with a gentleman from the European Commission. He said, oh, no, he said, I was scared of them. They held them in there. I crawled out the window. CNN recorded it. I was racing away. And so they really pushed them to not only to come to the peace table, but also when things at the peace table didn't seem to really have any legitimacy, to force them to really negotiate for peace. On the issue of sharing experiences, we do some of that, although it's not on the Congolese issue of gender-based violence. For example, the Rwandan women, some of you may know, have quite a storied history in their role in government. They're currently the highest percentage of female parliamentarians in the entire world. Their lower house is 48.8% women. It's the only place we have a project on the ground, and the Forum of Rwandan Women Parliamentarians recently had their 10th anniversary, and so we brought members of the legislative branch from Liberia, from Uganda, from Burundi, and I think one person from DRC together to talk about the experiences with reconciliation efforts, where Rwandan women had a big role in the ongoing reconciliation process there, and some issues related to the rape legislation, which is a concern in lots of places. We're currently also trying to share some of that experience around legislating and governing with women in the Sudanese parliament, where we're also active. So we do a lot of that sharing from one country to another. We do cross from west to east to South Africa and north. There's obviously scope to do more. That's just one example of the kind of work that we're doing. But because we have this global network, a big part of what we do is transferring experiences from one place to another and having people understand that they're not alone and that there are lessons that they can learn, both in terms of how problems have been approached and how they can develop and adapt solutions from one place to another.
I'd just like to add one comment concerning the DRC. Unfortunately, many times good things happen, but we do not hear about it. There is a partner group that also funds the Mana River Women Peace Network. It's called Farm Africa Solidarity, FAS. FAS works along with the women of the DRC and along with the women of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And FAS has arranged for meetings prior to the last fighting in the DRC for women to go in and to share experiences to see how they can move forward. Honorable Ruth Perry, who was an interim head of state of Liberia, and Mrs. Mary Brownell, they were two women who are Liberian women who were engaged in such a project with the DRC, funded by a partner called Fem Africa Solidarity. But you don't always hear these things, unfortunately.
I think you're right that there is scope for more face-to-face sharing. At the bank, we haven't done as much of that as we could, but we do have two mechanisms for sharing experiences within the bank among project teams of what works, what didn't work, what problems were encountered, etc. Those mechanisms are the post-conflict fund, which is run out of our social development unit, part of the group that works on post-conflict issues. And they have done a lot of work on gender issues in several post-conflict sections, situations, and they have some actually very good publications on gender issues in demobilization, reintegration, reconstruction, etc. So this, and it's pulled from, you know, places like Kosovo and DRC and all over, you know, Afghanistan, all those situations. We also now have a unit that works on issues in fragile states, and they are also collecting a lot of these experiences, not just good practices, but, you know, what problems there are. And actually, the Global Monitoring Report, which just came out last week, This is the bank IMF publication that tracks every year progress with the Millennium Development Goals. This year it focused on, every year it selects one topic, and this year the topic was gender, but with a focus on fragile states. So it has some useful info. It came out, it was launched just last week.
Thanks. I think there's a question in the back.
I'm interested, following up on the last question, on the transfer of the wealth of knowledge to the younger generation for the young women. And obviously, we learned so much through the process. I'm just wondering how younger women are being engaged in your efforts, if they are, and also if the World Bank has any initiatives that are particularly geared towards the youth and younger women.
Well, usually we always sit and reflect after we've done great work. And after the elections, we thought we had done a great job, and we sat to do our reflections. And one of the areas where we realized that we had failed miserably was in working, bridging that intergenerational gap. I'll tell a secret here. When we started our work, we avoided linking up with my WOPNET.
We knew that.
We avoided linking up with my WOPNET because we felt they had never bothered to carry us along, their generation. They were doing their work exclusively amongst their age and social class group. So we thought, okay, we'll start our own thing and we'll just go with that zeal. There was never a link. We just did, so they were doing their track one kind of peace building, and we were doing track two, track three basically at the grassroots level. When we started the mass action campaign, this first suggestion to involve them was almost like someone would chop my head off. But then after we sat and did our reflection, we realized that it was prior to elections. Then we wrote a pilot project to engage young women during the civic education process. And we took 25 women. What we wanted them to do was to go into their communities, pairing up to do civic education with their age group. And we realized that project was extremely, really, really successful. We were working with 25 women for 2 months. They came in a room with low self-esteem, you know, like any other post-conflict country. And then after 6 months of that project, after elections, we saw a real big transformation. At WOPNET, you still have some of them going to volunteer. But then we sat down and said we need to not just engage young women. Because if you also look at Liberia's sexual and gender-based violence, it's on the increase. In 2005, you had 157 reported cases. In 2006, 360 reported cases. So it's increasing. Maybe it's increasing for the better because the awareness is there now that people can go and say it. But we thought we need to start a project, and we're hoping that we can launch something like that called the Peace Generations. That's the name we're giving it, for young men and women in Liberia to break the barrier. But first, to engage the young women at our level so that they don't feel hateful towards us as we felt hateful towards this group. So we want to start continuing engaging with them, but also to engage with the young men so that they shift, you know, that whole thing of that idea. Because I have a 14-year-old. Nuku, can you go and sweep? No, it's a girl's job. Can you do this? No, it's a girl's job. So we're hoping that we can change that language from a girl's job to it's our job, you know, and so that people don't be hateful. Because during the elections, we heard a lot. I mean, some of the slogans that the young men use against Ellen or against the women of Liberia, some of the things they did, if they really understood the language that we are speaking, other men are speaking, we don't think they would have gone that far. So we're hoping that Peace Generations would engage them.
What's the bank doing? Yes, you know, the bank is organized in a matrix structure. We have the region, 6 regions where we do a lot of most of our operations, and then the networks. I think, and I'll have to check this when I go, but I think 4 out of the 6 regions have come up with youth
development strategies. I mean, reviewing the role of the youth in the regions. What are the issues facing the youth, especially transition from school to work issues. So I think it's 4 out of the 6 regions. The MENA region, actually the Middle East and North Africa region, has youth as one major development pillar of its overall regional strategy. The Africa region is also very much focused on that, especially in the context of HIV/AIDS. And within that, there's a lot of focus on the gender-based risks and vulnerability factors in the HIV/AIDS context, and they're coming up with several intervention strategies. And over about a year or so, they engaged in a lot of dialogue with very high-level, ministerial-level video conferences where they would bring different 4 or 5 countries together, ministers, civil society workers, and the youth and young people to engage in this dialogue. So we are beginning to think more about those issues, but the two themes that sort of predominate in those are HIV/AIDS and also how to make sure that the employment policies, laws, and frameworks are such that they would make a good bridge between young people coming out of school and finding gainful employment, because you know the unemployment and the sense of hopelessness among young people is a major problem that also has serious links to conflict.
I would just add 2 things. One is that when we had a meeting with the female ministers and deputy ministers, they identified the sort of mentoring of the next generation as really critical. And I don't know that what they've done about that, but it was one of their highest priorities, along with sort of closing the education gap. The other thing I would mention is what we think is really important vis-a-vis inclusion is how the local elections are targeted, because those are going to be supposed to take place in about a year. And it's really important that that process be used to bring in new leaders, leaders from throughout the country, folks who are local, the next generation of women. So I know that some of you do contracting and things. If you're looking for an opportunity, I mean, this is the time that there's an opportunity to get on the ground and start vesting the young people in the democratic process and mentoring the new leaders as part of the training for those elections, which will be in 2008.
Okay, I'm going to take 2 last questions. I'll take them together. First you and then you.
Edwina Adams, Howard University. I'd like to know, well, initially you stated that there was a grassroots effort to register a lot of women to vote. I'd like to know what part you played or what part your organization played in bringing Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to residency.
Okay.
We can't say we play any part.
Let me just take this last question, and you can answer them together.
I was wondering, my name is Mira Noll, and I played with the Bosnians, but I lived in Africa for 5 years. I was wondering, now that Charles Taylor and some of these generals are up for the ICC court or the court in Sierra Leone or The Hague or wherever they're deciding to try them, would they call you as witnesses against them, or what would you do since you worked with them already? I was just wondering how that works out if these men are convicted of genocide.
Well, I'll answer your question first. We can't be called in because Taylor is not being tried for crimes in Liberia for Sierra Leone, so we definitely cannot be called in to testify. And personally, even if I was called, let's say out of 1 million chance, I would not. Not that I support whatever they did, but I think we still have a lot of issues in Liberia, and testifying and then going back home will not be in the best interest of peace and security. Even if something happens to me, the rest of the women on the ground, how do you engage? We haven't even started the process of reconciliation yet. So at our level, I think we should stay completely out of international processes that never included us in the first place when they were making their decisions?
Many people have criticized the Ellen Joseph Sirleaf government for not pressing in the trial of Mr. Taylor. But to buttress what Lema has said, we have lost so much that we are focusing on peace. And we do not want to create a situation where the country is once more destabilized. Taylor is being tried for crimes committed in Sierra Leone. So that's why we're keeping ourselves, most Liberians, there are many who want him to be tried even in Liberia, but most Liberians prefer to focus on peace, the sustenance of peace, rather than on one person, Mr. Taylor. No, not to our knowledge.
The TRC mandate is blanket amnesty. That is, if people go to testify, similar to what was done in South Africa, except where at the end of the day, their findings show that one person had committed so much and in their recommendation that this person needed to be brought to justice. But for now, it's amnesty for those who will be going in. Even though we had our own opinion about it at the peace talks, but again, because the representation, women were represented at the level of observers during the peace talk, and our concerns were not really taken into consideration.
After the disarmament process, some of the generals have been reintegrated into society. There's one or two who are in government because of the agreement that was made. So some of them are doing business. They're engaged in business and they've been reintegrated. So they are not really being tried.
Back to your question. We can't say we did anything. I mean, sitting here to really take the glory for Ellen's going into power would be something that would really be too much to say. But I know that we laid the foundation. When women went out there to protest for peace, when we started talking about benchmarks and talking politics, and then the mere fact that we went out into the community, general minister, and I always would look at each other and laugh and say we've been to places. Because some of the places we slept when we were trying to encourage women just to register and vote one night, she's lying on this big rat walk over her face. She said, my God, after this, I don't know what will happen to us. But we went out there because we know Liberian women, the culture. Liberia had their first elections in 1840-something, and women and indigenous property owners did not vote till 1959. So you know, and then beyond that, how many times did we have elections for them to take part? So we had to really go out there. And by the time we did that campaign and came to the end, we had 50+1 more women registered to vote than men. So after you've done that calculation, if you had 50+1 more women registered, and in the final analysis, you had a man and a woman, definitely it took a gender dimension. And the song we sang was, this is our time, you know, during the second round. Women, this is our time. So people went out there saying, if we don't see it now, women went out there with that mind, that if we don't vote this way now, we'll never get it again for the next 100+ years.
And as she said, the women were not accustomed to exercising their franchise. Many of them would say, if I go out to vote, who's going to look after my market? And we would tell them, if you don't have peace, if you have fighting, you will have no market. So it was a matter of a continuous training, education, that encouraged them to go out and exercise their franchise.
Well, and you also created a system to sit at their market stall.
Oh, yeah. Right?
They went to vote.
That final week when we were doing the 5 days of the final day for voters registration, the 20 teams, we set up the team, 10 teams of 20 women, and then one team in the office. I'm there with cell phone to my ear, and then they will call and say, we are at this center and there is no ink. Then we'll call the election commissions and say, at center so and so, there is no ink. And the commissioner, the chair of the commission, was her line was always open to my line. So Madam Chair, we don't have ink at this center, or they've run out of film for photographing the people, and she will send people there.
And then some of the women will go behind tables. We went to some communities and they say, we don't have anyone to take care of our babies. So we put babies on our backs. And some of them will say, you know, I'm not motivated. How can you let God speak to me? And we sang songs and dance and said prayers. And some of the women will preach, you know, God say you should do this. But at the end of the day, we went to some schools where the children were saying they were not going to. We had meetings with them, and then they said, we don't have money to transport ourselves. We chartered buses and took them to... I mean, it was just 5 days of intense work. And at the end of the day, we got the result that we never thought we would get, but we did get it.
I think it's also clear from that the president views you as a really important constituency. I mean, so it's not only them talking about what it is they did, but the way she has responded to their mobilization, and that remains the case today. I mean, she routinely, you know, emphasizes the need to stay engaged on this agenda, and it's not, I mean, I think she's committed, but it's not just that she's committed, it's that this is a key electoral block in Liberia.
I mean, you go and you talk to her about issues of concern. I mean, December, we were in there, and once she heard that this group of community women wanted to do a project and the Minister of Public Works was stopping her with this thing of the president said, she sent for us. Said, I don't have anything to do with this. Can we talk to him and see where this whole thing of the president... So she's really very open, but then where we need to understand that it's not just for us that she's there. You have the youth population. And she's thinking economy. There's so much that Liberia needs right now. And so we have to really put our issues to bear. I tell you, in 2005, it was the first time. And when I talk about Liberian women not knowing about any policy issue, we really need to push on this area, like you were talking. We didn't know that from the existence of government, that within the Rural Development Fund, they had a Rural Women Development Fund. We didn't find out till 2005. And everyone's like, you mean there is a budgetary allocation within the government for rural women development, and these women come down to Monrovia to lobby NGOs to help them? So somewhere, these men have been taking this money, and women leaders didn't know. But if we know all of these things that are in the books, for us, we can go to her and engage her. So I think we should not just sit back. We need to really redouble our effort if this government should succeed, because that's one of the challenges for us. If Ellen fails today, not just Liberian women, but the entire African nation, for women to see even, I would say, a janitorial position, if it is electable, it will be difficult. We need to ensure success for this government, whether we like it or not.
I know we're 2 minutes over. I think Lema's point is a really important one, because I know you guys focus a lot on what the needs are going forward. And I would sort of say this to you, office, in terms of what's key, that Lema's point about how do you move from such a potent civil society movement working outside of government to translating that into working the system is really hard. And, I mean, we've been working on it, but we're, you know, teeny-weeny. So any support within the context of the PRS or elsewhere that can give the tools for how you advocate within a democracy as a civil society movement, I think, is really critical to the success of that women's movement in challenging itself to in enabling it to work in a paradigm of peace, because it's been extraordinarily effective in a paradigm of conflict, but that's a big transformation.
Yeah. I think I couldn't agree with you more, and I think the full PRS process, as we discussed in February, is going to be absolute key, because that is when Liberia will be setting its policies, and all the funding will be channeled through that. And if between now and 18 months or 2 years, when 18 months we think, we do not work with civil society, the Ministry of Gender, you know, others in the country to really very well articulate the gender issues, women's specific issues, not only and I think in the areas like violence and violence against women and those issues, they'll be very well articulated. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the real issues of development, real access to financial resources, real access to productive resources, which are all the issues that the PRS will address. If we are not able to articulate within that a special or a specific, not even special, but a specific focus, how to write that policy in such a way that it will take the needs of both women and men into account, we would have missed an opportunity. We would then write another general poverty reduction strategy. So I think there's a real opportunity here that one should not miss.
Okay, thank you very much to all of you for coming, and a special thank you to this great panel for a very inspirational session, especially Lema and Juanita for your courage going forward. Thanks, we'll be publishing a short piece brief in the next few weeks, so look for that on our website. Thank you.
Thank you very much.